So we're working with these preliminary instructions. They are instructions for samadhi practice. Samadhi is the eighth limb of the Noble Eightfold Path. And samadhi is always formally defined in the texts as the four jhanas. Jhana is a word that translates usually as absorption. And it's the Pali version of a word you might know in Sanskrit, particularly folks who have been through the yoga world a bit, might know it as dhyana. That word was transliterated into chan in Chinese, which was further transliterated into son in Korean and zen in Japanese and tien in Vietnamese. So all of those, which became styles of Buddhist practice, lineage, whole lineages, are all based on this word jhana. And the meaning of it changed as it morphed into zen, in the zen direction, in the northern traditions. But it always refers to schools of practice that put a strong emphasis on meditation over other forms of practice like chanting and ritual and study. So jhana, broadly, is the limb of practice that teaches us how to rest in particular helpful states of body mind. They're really energetic states. They're ways of using and stabilizing attention. And they are characterized by a number of qualities, including very consistent use of attention. So steadied and stabilized and consistently held attention. They're characterized in their initial phases by strong energy in the body. Or you could call it in the body. It feels like energy. You could call it in the energy body, an awakening of the energy body. Sometimes this word piti is translated as rapture. Other times joy. I prefer rapture. I also really like a translation used by the Samatha Trust people, a different jhana school over in the UK, coming from a different Thai lineage. And they use the term energization. So not even rapture, which can have out of sort of spiritualized overtones, but just energizing the body is piti. And then sukha, which is a kind of more emotional, perhaps ease or happiness or profound contentment and single-pointedness. These are all qualities of jhana. And the jhana states themselves are a set of increasingly still or stable, fully absorbed states of attention. So they're states that are deeply undistracted, deeply pleasurable. All of them are considered profoundly pleasurable, delicious states, nourishing for the nervous system. To use nervous system language, I would say that they're states of profound deactivation out of nervous system stress. So they have dropped far away from the fight, flight, freeze, and fawn area of nervous system activation into, through really a profoundly embodied present state, and then further into internal states of deep safety and ease and energy. They start off with first jhana, which is characterized by aiming and sustaining attention in a volitional or willful way. But as soon as one reaches second jhana, that willful effort is dropped away. And all the states subsequent to that are easy to maintain without willful maintenance of attention. They still have to be trained. You still have to work on them. But they get more and more and more effortless as they go on. The pleasure gets subtler and deeper. Until fourth jhana, which is an embodied state of perfect mindfulness, profound equanimity, and stability of mind. They are marvelous. And all the reports about them are that they are the pinnacle of the meditative side of Buddhist practice. And I'll emphasize the meditative side, making a slight distinction with Vipassana, which I'll talk about in a minute, as not just a meditation, but really an inquiry. There's lots of different ways to practice jhana, but they all include methods for stabilizing attention. And long before one gets to jhana, attention has to be stabilized, which is why these preliminaries are helpful. Preceding jhana is a state, or really a whole landscape of states, that can be called access or neighborhood concentration, or neighborhood samadhi. The Pali is upachara samadhi. And these are states that are moving toward absorption but are not fully absorbed yet. In most of the jhana traditions, it's considered that there's a very clear, distinct shift into the absorption. So it's not just a gradual slide. Am I in it? Am I in it? Am I in it? If you're still asking that question, you're not in it. There's a clunk or a landing or a whoop up. My teacher Eugene was like, everyone says it kind of goes clunk down, but he was like, no, it goes up. But you know, whatever, directional metaphors, it changes in a crisp kind of way. For most folks, it seems like. Preceding jhana, however, is a long area of states that are characterized particularly by the absence of the hindrances. So the beginning of moving toward these states is to work with the hindrances to bring them all to rest. So all five of the classic hindrances are disturbances, in a way, in the energetic field. So the first two hindrances have kind of an emotional quality to them. There's kamachanda, sense desire, and ill will. Sense desire and ill will, so wanting and hating, have this kind of, and remember, it's hatred and ill will. It's not just aversion, like, oh yeah, I don't like that sensation. I don't like the flavor of that sauce, or I don't like when I stub my toe. Like, sure, I don't like those things. I'm aversive to those. But those by themselves are not a hindrance. The hindrance is ill will. It's really hatred. It's like, I hate that. I don't like those people. I don't like that activity. I'm stirred up by it. Plain old aversion, I could just be like, I don't like that activity, and therefore I'm not going to do it, and I'm not upset or worried or anxious at all about it. Aversion is like, I'm afraid of it. I hate it. I don't want to do it. I'm resisting it. So the first two hindrances have this kind of emotional force to them, and that stirs up the psyche. So then that's why they're hindrances, and they're particularly hindrances to concentration. You can't concentrate if either of those things are present. The third and fourth hindrances are both double words, sloth and torpor, and restlessness and worry. Sometimes those are themselves teased apart into a physical and mental aspect, where sloth is kind of like, that's the old Victorian word for laziness, right? That's kind of the emotional side. And then torpor is like the physical dullness, like I'm sleepy, I'm dull, I feel heavy. And likewise, restlessness and worry, where restlessness is kind of physical and worry is more mental. But in a way, if the first two, sense desire and ill will, are kind of emotional, they're sort of two ends of an emotional spectrum that stir one up. I think of the third and fourth hindrances, sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry, as two ends of the energetic spectrum, where I'm stirred up. My energy is either low and muddled or too high and scattered. And so whether it's physical or mental, and it can be helpful just to distinguish them, I think of the third and fourth hindrances as the energetic spectrum. So there's an emotional spectrum where you want to stay away from the intensities at the ends, and there's an energetic spectrum where you want to stay away from the intensities at the ends. In both cases, you're coming toward a kind of middle way between extremes. And then the fifth one, skeptical doubt, just stay away from it altogether, right? All of the realms of self-doubt, other doubt, doubting the teacher, doubting the Dhamma, doubting the Buddha, doubting your friends, doubting yourself, doubting your parents, doubting the culture, doubting existence itself. It's all stirring up the heart-mind. Now, doubt is tricky because until you have direct experience that something like the Dhamma is helpful and good, you might be reasonably convinced that being skeptical is helpful, right? Like, don't just jump into this faith, you know, blindly. You might get swept away in a cult and suddenly you're wearing red robes and you're living in the jungle in Burma. I did that. My Catholic mother wasn't sure if this was good where I was. And I, you know, I wrote home and I was like, Mom, it's great. It's not a cult. You know, she was still praying for me every night. Bless her soul. But, you know, so some doubt is helpful when you're trying to figure out who to hang out with. But it's a hindrance to concentration, right? So you got to figure that out. Otherwise, the mind is still going to be stirred up. So do your doubting in the right context and then figure out how to set it aside. And until you can set aside all five of these hindrances, you won't get anywhere close to absorption, right? Because these are these things are stirring up the mind. But of course, worry loops in almost everything that we do in the mind. You know, all of the thinking about past and future could be lumped into the restlessness and worry hindrance. And a huge amount of what fills our cognitive emotional space, our heart space, is some variation of wanting and fearing stuff. So first two hindrances. And so to get to access concentration, to neighborhood absorption, upachara samadhi, subduing the hindrances, requires a fair amount of work, right? You're like, you know, I have one of the books on deep samadhi practice that I have is Shaila Catherine's presentation of the path as presented by the PAOK system. It's called Wisdom Wide and Deep. And, you know, she basically, in the first 20 pages of the book is about 300 pages long. In about the first 20 pages, she says, you know, subdue the hindrances, come into, you know, steady concentration with the breath, and then stay with it until the nimitta, the image of the breath, appears. And you're on the edge of first jhana. And I'm like, you got there in 10 pages and there's 300, you know, there's 290 pages to go that depend on you attaining that beginning. And there's a huge amount of material in the Buddhist system that depends on the attainment of jhana first. Jhana is not the end point. Jhana itself is a preliminary for a lot of things. But for a lot of us in the traumatized, scattered world that we are in now, it's nearly impossible to attain. It takes a fair amount of training, and I'm not gonna oversell jhana here. It's challenging. The good thing about it is that any bit of concentration, any bit of samadhi that you have is healthy. Even the tiniest bit. Even moments where the hindrances soften and you're not in their, you know, in their curved stainless steel claws for a few moments, is profoundly nourishing for the heart. And every bit of concentration practice is helpful. So don't worry about how far you get. The big hindrance with jhana is, of course, the ghost of attainment and non-attainment. And just don't worry about it. It's a hindrance. You know, it's just a hindrance. The pathway to jhana is profound relaxation. All of you who were with me through the Anapanasati sequence heard this. The pathway is to relax profoundly through the body and through the mind, and to come to a stable, pleasurable stillness through feeling very, very safe, very much at ease, and able to set aside the hindrances for a while. So that's the bulk of the instructions, and I'm personally in favor of working on the instructions for samadhi very, very assiduously in the beginning of one's practice, which might mean most of this lifetime for some of us. But that's a little bit about what jhana is and where it's going and how those preliminaries relate to it. Because to approach these states, you're not just letting everything come and go. You actually have to be purposeful with your state, right? Remember, the sixth limb of the Eightfold Path is wise effort. This is the effort that it takes to cultivate wholesome states and diminish unwholesome states. And this means you have to choose between them. And when there's an unwholesome state present, like the hindrances, do what you can to get it to subside. You don't just... I never invite the hindrances in for tea. Nothing in the Pali Canon says to invite the hindrances in for tea. That's a common shorthand instruction given in the insight world sometimes. The reason for that instruction is that so many of us are so profoundly self-critical that instead of just subduing a hindrance and inviting a wholesome state in its place, we encounter a hindrance and then we beat ourselves up for having it. And so the instruction to be kind to yourself and to invite the hindrances in and to reject nothing is a very skillful instruction when the primary thing you're working with is self-hatred. You have to actually figure out how to do this delicate maneuver of being discerning and critical about your own states and really wanting to improve yourself in meditation and in practice, without thinking that that means that anything's wrong with you, or that you have done something wrong, or that somehow you're not meditating very well. You actually have to be able to tell yourself that you're not meditating very well without taking it personally, without thinking it means anything about your quality or your worth. You are a marvelous, scintillating, perfect human being who could use some work in the meditation department, because we've all been trained to be neurotic with our attention. Our attention span sucks, by and large, as modern people. And this is no new thing. You know, Socrates was said to have lamented that when people became literate and learned to read rather than memorize, their minds would go to hell because they wouldn't know how to remember things anymore. They would just trust the written word. And he was right. It worked, right? Now that nobody reads and you just rely on the internet being always available to you, because you don't have to remember anything anymore. You just look it up on Wikipedia if you need it, you know? You don't remember anybody's phone numbers anymore because they're stored in your phone. This is the same thing that Socrates was speaking to, only amplified even more. But what's the result of the mind not being able to remember? That's also it's the same thing as the mind not being able to be present. Because sustaining attention in the present in the way that we do in meditation is the same faculty that we use to remember things. Right? There's a kind of connectivity of attention that sustains, where we can track one thought to the next. That's how you remember things, is you remember linkages between things. If we can't sustain attention, we can't sustain linkage. So, mindfulness, this limb between right effort and right absorption or immersion, samadhi, mindfulness is also not the practice of letting everything come and go. Letting everything come and go is a form of practice that, again, it works to heal us of the particular hindrance of liking some things and hating some other things. So if we're really lost in the first two hindrances, and who isn't really? You know, I know a few, but they're special people. Who isn't lost in wanting things to be a certain way and wishing they weren't other ways? Really craving certain sensory experiences and really being afraid of others. That's the first two hindrances. But that also means that as I'm becoming present, the main first thing that I become present to is vedana, right? Pleasant and unpleasant, pinging my system all the time. I like this, I don't like that. I like this, I don't like that. And so before I can really do the work of subduing unwholesome states and uplifting wholesome ones, I have to somehow deal with these first two hindrances. And I think this is what basic mindfulness does. So basic mindfulness instructions, they start off with some amount of stabilization. Usually there's the instruction to take something like the breath as an anchor. But then instead of just staying with it in a dogged, you know, don't get distracted by anything else, become fully silent with the breath. That's a concentration instruction. The mindfulness instructions often start off with first, you know, stabilize with an anchor like the breath, but then notice pleasant and unpleasant sensations. Like, wake up to vedana. Wake up to the fact that, like, I prefer the sound of the frogs and I don't prefer the sound of the hard drive clicking and humming over there. Tiny little vedana, right? But if I was really hooking into that, I might spend some time in my meditation going, I really should deal with that hard drive. I don't like it. I know I need it for the recording, but I don't like the clicking sound. Maybe I should buy a solid state hard drive. I need a new hard drive. You know, I could get distracted based on not being mindful of the vedana, right? I didn't notice that what was happening was it was unpleasant. Not noticing the unpleasantness, I got lost in a distraction, right? I could do the same thing with the pleasant. So mindfulness first says, you know, start to notice the body, like just become present to the body. You'll notice pleasant and unpleasant sensations. You'll notice pleasant and unpleasant sensory information from all the senses. And then third foundation of mindfulness, you'll notice pleasant and unpleasant emotional states. That's not actually what the third foundation of mindfulness is, but that's our shorthand for it. The third foundation actually says, notice the presence or absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, and the presence or absence of concentration, distraction, and liberation. So it's actually much more specific than notice emotions. There's no such thing in the Buddhist world as an emotion, in Buddhist philosophy as an emotion. As a distinctly heart-centered state that's different from thoughts and different from energetic state. The Buddhist world doesn't divide thoughts and feelings into two categories. What it divides states into is wholesome and unwholesome. So you have the list of the hindrances. Some of them are kind of emotional, some of them are kind of thinky, but they're all unwholesome. And you have the list of the seven awakening factors, which are all wholesome. Some of them are more emotional, like joy. Some of them are more energetic, you know, like rapture. Or energy itself, virya. Some of them are more cognitive, like investigation, but they're all wholesome. So the third foundation of mindfulness is really specific states that are important to notice. And it really means notice, is there greed present or is there greed absent? And it's just as important to notice its absence than its presence. Is there distraction or is there concentration? And then the fourth foundation has a whole bunch of lists that are important to notice as you're tracking your practice. So vipassana is a form of targeted mindfulness practice. It uses some concentration, but it doesn't try to stay with one object. Vipassana is a way of practicing where you use observation to understand how the mind is pulled by these various aspects of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, sensory experiences, thoughts and feelings. And by observing them without trying to change them necessarily, you are meant to come to an insight into impermanence. That's the primary goal of vipassana. And so the aim is different. Traditionally, they are not two separate arenas of practice, but they're two aspects of the same practice. And it's arguable that the original intent with the foundations of mindfulness was in part that mindfulness is a foundation for samadhi, like you need some amount of tracking all this stuff to be able to get into samadhi. That's why mindfulness is the seventh limb and samadhi is the eighth. It's also arguable that mindfulness is what you do when you have attained enough samadhi to be able to do the exercises contained in the limb of mindfulness. Because there's nothing in the limb of mindfulness, seventh limb of the Eightfold Path, that says be aware of everything. That instruction doesn't exist. There's not even anything that says be aware of, you know, the whole of bodily experience. That's an abstraction. What it actually says is be aware of postures, specific movements, specific actions, and then it has a series of distinct inquiries or exercises to do that are meant to help you deconstruct identity. So it says, see the body as parts, like you're sorting out a bag of mixed beans into their different components, you know. If you had a bag that had peas and rice and lentils all mixed together and you were going to sort them out and say, you know, this is split peas and this is red lentils and this is brown rice and this is white rice and put them all in separate piles, it says, reflect on the body like this. This is head hair. This is body hair. These are nails. This is teeth. This is skin. You know, this is the organs. This is the fluids, etc. Deconstruct the body and onward, you know, from there. So concentration practice then, or samadhi practice, broadly is all of these kinds of practice that that focus on stabilizing attention toward, not just because it's helpful to have stable attention, but because it's amazing to use that stabilized attention to enter these profound states of absorption, incredible states of stability that purely from a nervous system perspective are deeply healing, but also are the nourishment the heart mind most needs to be able to do the work of being on the path of uprooting the defilements. Vipassana is a way of using the cultivated mind, that particularly that mind that has some concentration that's powerful enough, using that mind in a series of directed exercises to understand the impermanent, unsatisfying, and selfless nature of existence. So vipassana is an inquiry, most directly, where samadhi is a cultivation of a state. Modern mindfulness is a blend of these two things, and modern secular mindfulness mashes these two things together. It usually starts off with an anchor like the breath, and then it opens to all things. And it brings in instructions like, let everything come and go, don't be preferential, notice everything as it arises and passes, let everything be just as it is, but notice it. Those instructions, I think, are, again, they're excellent preliminaries for the more focused practices, either of samadhi practice or of vipassana. They're really a preliminary to vipassana. And they're a preliminary because they don't ask the practitioner to do anything specific in relation to cultivating insight. Those instructions trust that insight will arise on its own just from remaining in a wide open state. And I think that does happen for some people. The people who I think it happens most for are the folks who take that instruction to remain in a wide open state, both literally and very precisely. In other words, when a thought arises that's a distraction, they notice it as a distraction right away and don't let it play out. Because if you're letting it play out, there's another quality present and it's going to be a hindrance. Right? There's going to be wanting. Like this fantasy is pleasurable. I'm not noticing the vedana of pleasure, liking. And I'm also not noticing that there's sensory desire. Remember that thinking is a sense object. I'm wanting this thought. And I'm unwilling to stop it because it's actually more pleasurable than sitting here with my breath, which is kind of boring, and my hip aches, and I'm tired. So I'm just going to follow this fantasy. But I'm actually not being mindful now, because I'm missing the Vedana, and I'm missing the hindrance of sense desire, and I'm missing restlessness. And so the way that the wide open instruction works is if you do it very, very precisely, actually, and you catch everything as it arises, and you're like, yeah, there's a thought, and there's a sound, and now there's a sensation, and there's another thought, and there's a sound. And this is actually what the formal instruction that led to this wide open awareness thing was meant to do. And the formal instruction is the kind of instruction you'll get like on a Mahasi style retreat, where you give a mental label to these things every 2 seconds or so. And so your inner dialogue actually sounds like this: hearing, sensing, swallowing, hearing, hearing, wondering, sensing. And what I'm doing, that's the way I do it. I just give the sort of the ing words, the verby words, what I'm doing. But those are shorthand for, like, you know, sensing a constriction in the belly, hearing the frogs, feeling that my mouth is a little dry, thinking about what to say next. And I generally just use the verb label. Other folks will use more of a content label, and they'll say frogs, dry, achy, achy, planning, right? Those are different, right? You're naming more the content. It actually works either way. You can name the content or you can name the action. What you're doing is you're noticing the movement of attention. When attention is unbound by concentration, it's going to ping. And if you do this in a persistent way, I was always pretty slow at this, but I did it for 5 months in Burma when I was there. And that's from waking to sleeping, trying not to miss a note at all through the whole day. It took me a few months to get momentum with it. And then after I did, it starts to get pretty trippy. That's a deconstructive practice. And so what you're going to do there is you're trying to, and you'll develop some concentration while doing that, of course, but it's not stable. You're not trying to stabilize. You're, in a certain way, you're trying to destabilize. Like, you're trying to let go of the things you hold on to as a false stabilization, like your story of yourself, the story of continuity. And you're actually just noticing that actually things are changing constantly. Ping, 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 ping. And as you notice that, it starts to break down your sense of the continuity of yourself. And you start to notice that everything is happening because it was caused by something else. And nothing lasts. And nothing is really satisfying. Pleasurable things, they're gone in an instant. Painful things, you can't prevent them. They just show up. And none of it is yourself. So you have the insight into karma. That's really, this is kind of the first three insights in the insight sequence are the insight into how the label for a thing and the thing itself are different. That really shows you something about how the mind is in relation to the world. And then you notice cause and effect, karma. And then you notice the three characteristics. Then you're in. And then the sequence really starts to roll. And so vipassana is a practice meant to induce this sequence of deconstructive insights. And samadhi practice is meant to induce states of profound nourishment and ease. And so as we practice, I'll finish with this, as we practice, part of what the fun and interest and skill in practice is, but it's really a skill to be learned, is how we adjust, sometimes moment by moment, sometimes season by season in our practice, how we adjust what kind of practice we're doing. What's going to be most helpful for this body-mind now, in this moment in my life, in this particular morning of practice, you know, like tomorrow morning when you go to sit or whenever you sit, what do you do? Do you go into an open awareness practice? Do you try to sustain attention on one thing? Do you go for silence? It takes some skill to learn, in the same way that as I was, you know, when I was a serious practicer of the piano, every day sitting down at the instrument, I had to figure out whether I was going to do like a whole bunch of technical exercises, I'm running my scales and exercises, or if I was going to learn repertoire and actually work on a piece, or if I was going to do a free improvisation. And they're all valuable. They're really different channels in the attention and the action. Samadhi and vipassana are both super valuable. They're really different. And so part of the skill in practice is actually to figure out, and of course they're a spectrum, right? They're not actually a binary, right? There's ways where you have lots of concentration and not much changing object, a medium amount of concentration and some changing objects, but you're still diminishing the hindrances. You know, some concentration, but not trying to hold the object at all and letting it just spin on its own. And then there's a thing that a lot of people do kind of accidentally, which is very little concentration, but they're trying to let everything go on its own. And this is the state that I think gets taught a lot in some modern systems. And it's the state that I'm actually most critical of, to be honest. I think that without enough concentration and with the instruction to just let everything come and go, I see students get stuck in a spinning loop of neurotic hindrance encouragement for decades. Because we're trying to accept everything as it comes and goes, but we don't actually have the stability of heart to do so. And so I feel like we're just being assaulted by the hindrances constantly because the conditions are so strong and we're not actually intervening in the state. Maybe this is a parallel to, like, you know, parents who refuse to discipline their children at all, because they've learned that being permissive is better. I feel like there's a pathway that's a good middle way here, where we are simultaneously learning to accept all parts of ourselves without criticism, because we are worth it, because we're worthy of that love and acceptance, and at the same time learning how to discipline our states with determination and even a kind of passionate training to become better. Right? You don't become a skilled musician without disciplining your practice. You don't just indulge in mistakes. You don't improve if you do that. But you don't have to beat yourself up for making mistakes either. Please don't. It's just training. It's a kind of sport. And without practice, without assiduous practice and believing that you can do it, it just doesn't improve very much. And it is a skill. So we'll pause there. I think I kept going because you never want to end with a stick on this one. So, really the samadhi side, the concentration side of the spectrum, I think for most of us is the least developed part of our practice, and it's the most worth giving attention and training to, and it bears great fruit, even if you only get a little way along. Whatever you think of as a little way, every little bit helps quite a bit, I think. All right, so we'll pause there. Thank you. And